In 1979, the Australian director George Miller created one of the most amazing action-adventure franchises, the post-apocalyptic dystopian vision of Mad Max. Here on Fandom Podcast Network, we look at all four Mad Max films from The Road Warrior. That's right, from Mad Max 1979 to Mad Max 2, The Road Warrior, to Mad Max 3, Beyond Thunderdome, and tonight, we look at the one, the only, 2015's amazing blockbuster, Mad Max Fury Road, a potential reboot for one of the most amazing franchises around. Here on Maximum Couch Potato.
Welcome to the Fandom Podcast Network's Couch Potato Theatre. We proudly present to you our fourth installment in our Mad Max retrospective, Maximum Couch Potato. Part four, looking at, of course, 2015's amazing dystopian fantastic film, Mad Max Fury Road, directed by George Miller, starring Tom Hardy and Charlize Theron. We have done this in four installments so far. We've been looking at both Mad Max and The Road Warrior, and recently we looked at Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome. If you haven't checked those out, you should, because there's a lot of trivia and stuff that you're going to find about these films, and even insight that we found out as a team as we talked about it. And I think the big surprise for us was Beyond Thunderdome. But getting to it, my team here today, we're going to introduce everybody, myself included. I am Adam O'Brien, the Australian correspondent for Fantatrax, and also of Lethal Mullet Podcast here on the network. I'm the host of the 80s retrospective of that. And also, you can find me also doing the Star Wars show on Fantatrax, which is, of course, Fantha from Down Under. Joining me today is the amazing co-founders of this huge, amazing channel, Fandom Podcast Network. We're going to start with Kevin, the Raider Nerd Writes, and of course, Kyle Wagner. Gentlemen, how are we?
What's going on, man? It's fun to be back for this final installment of the Mad Max quadrilogy, I guess you could say. I've been looking forward to this one, being the most recent installment of the Mad Max franchise and a new fresh look into that world of Mad Max. And I'm excited, man. This is really cool.
I was promised chrome, damn it. Where is my shiny chrome?
No, it's fun to be here. I'm excited about this one. I think we are diving into what, in my personal opinion, is the best of the Mad Max films. So I'm ready to bring it on and take a trip down the Fury Road.
Awesome. Now, tonight, obviously, we're going to be looking at the 2015 classic, and we've decided that we also want to hear from you listeners as well. So we've got a tweet out to all channels to see if anyone's out on Twitter today, their thoughts on the film. But also, we're looking at maybe even doing a part two to this actual show, where we look at your feedback as listeners and even maybe have some dear friends of the show, perhaps Mr. Clifton, for his thoughts on the Fury. So we'll get into that a little bit later on tonight. But right now, we're going to talk about 2015's film very soon. But before we get into it, we're going to talk about how you can get in contact with Fandom Podcast Network. So, Kyle, take it away.
Well, of course, you can find the Fandom Podcast Network at our homepage at fpnet.podbean.com, where you can find our master feed and the archives of all our great shows. And if you're using a mobile device, you can always download the Podbean app and search Fandom Podcast Network. Of course, you can also find us on iTunes, Stitcher, for you Android users, Google Play. And of course, now we're also on Spotify. Just do a search for the Fandom Podcast Network. Of course, visit our homepage at on Facebook. Just search Fandom Podcast Network. And you can also email us at fandompodcastnetwork@gmail.com. And you can follow us on social media, also on Instagram at Fandom Podcast Network, or on Twitter at FanPod Network. You can find myself, Kyle, on Twitter at AKyleW, or on Instagram at AKyleFandom. Kevin, where can people find you on the social media these days?
You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Spartan_Phoenix.
And you can also catch me, the host here, at Obi Pop Culture on both Twitter and Instagram on those handles. Or if you want to catch me on my Star Wars work, you can catch me at fantatrax.com. But we're going to be talking about the one, the only, George Miller-directed fantastic epic. It's kind of like the ultimate, I think, when it comes to dystopian films. This is one that I think we've been waiting for so long that we didn't know what we were going to get. At one stage, it was going to be a Mel Gibson film. But with Tom Hardy involved, it became something even more exciting, I think. So we're going to talk about our first thoughts on the film before we get into the actual film itself. So, Simon, Kev, when you saw this film, what was the immediate gut reaction to it?
My first gut reaction was how action-packed that it was, but still it did not sacrifice the story and the character development, which I thought was really cool. And honestly, I can't not think about how awesome the cars were in this film, which has been one of my favorite things about the Mad Max films is the cars.
Definitely. And Kyle, your thoughts when you first saw the film?
I walked out of the theater after seeing Fury Road, and I was like, I hadn't seen anything like that in a good long time, and I knew I had seen something different and something special. But I think for me, I mean, the action was incredible. But I mean, the thing I came walking out of it was, with a lot of people, I think the same way, was what a performance by Charlize Theron.
Oh, definitely. I think for me, it was two things. It was the spectacle of the stunts work, and particularly, I think, yeah, Theron pretty much took over the film for me as far as her power. She really gave a performance of a lifetime in this film, unlike any other character. She's unlike even characters that we've had previously in the Mad Max franchise, where I think we see a full hero story with her that we've never seen. I mean, Max is pretty much a standstill Western gunfighter style character, where he is not as much, goes through his, even though in the last couple of films we've seen him grow, but characters like, Furiosa really, really show that this is such a fantastic franchise for mythic heroes' journeys. But let's have a look at the actual film itself, talk about the plot. So this film is not connected to the other films officially. This film is one that reboots the franchise. So we've got Max left alone, out as a survivor, basically a feral. We don't know how long he's been out there by himself as a wanderer. And he gets picked up by a pack of war boys running from Immortan Joe's empire. So he's basically drawn into as a blood donor or a blood slave to a lot of what they call the war boys, which are the soldier army of Immortan Joe, who's the dictator of the Citadel. And what we see is basically from there on one of the greatest basically chase films ever. And the actual growth as a story, you learn about the world as the chase goes on. Because really, when you face it, the film is 2 hours of solid chasing. The action is never on the ground, it's always in the cars, the stunt work included. So we see Immortan Joe basically chase Furiosa, a renegade, who takes with her the war brides and try to get to safety, to where she was originally born. So when we look at films like this, Road Warrior wasn't even as much of a chase movie as this is. This is really a plot on four wheels the entire time. Wouldn't you say, Kong?
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, there's some moments, obviously, where not so much, especially in the beginning, and there's a couple of kind of peaceful moments in the middle of the film. But, I mean, this film is it's all about the gas, the engine, the combustible speed, everything that you can possibly imagine. And I sit back and I still watch this movie, and I just wonder, what was George Miller thinking of when he was making this to pull off some of the most spectacular car stunts I've ever seen in a movie?
Oh, definitely. And Kev, what do you reckon?
Oh, I would agree with Kyle's assessment to that. I think this is probably why this is my favorite of the series. Because it really showed how important being mobile in this vast wasteland is. When I was watching the special features on the DVD, George Miller said that what's important about this world is that the cars are basically power. They allow you to keep the land that you have and to take more. And that's why gasoline's so important, or guzzoline, as they would say in these films. It's to live and to prosper in this wasteland, being able to be mobile and reach vast parts of this wasteland is important. And I love the fact that in this movie, you get not only a taste of the vehicles, but you basically are served a full dinner, feels like a three-course dinner of awesome cars, because you get the great chase scene in the beginning. And then when the decision is made in the film to go back, you get another one of those. And then the other cool thing about it is you get other factions that are living in this wasteland, whether they are working with Immortan Joe or not. And I love the fact that you get different aspects of others living in the wasteland.
I really think, yeah, you're right. You've nailed one thing. The world building in this film is probably the best out of all of the four films. He really has thought it up. First of all, the idea of a citadel, where the biggest power there, apart from fuel or gasoline, is water. You know, the fact that he's got these massive tanks, he's got, on top of the citadel itself, fertile area where he's actually growing plants. I mean, that's something unheard of in the universe previously, apart from the first one, I suppose. But what's interesting, too, is, as you say, Kevin, the different factions. So we not only see the ones where Furiosa was coming from, so you've got that part of it, but you've also got the bullet farmer. You've got the different little tribes as they go along on the chase to try to steal their load, to hijack their shipment as they go along. So there's so much out there that we haven't seen before. And I think what's interesting is even George Miller, I think, wanted to tie it originally to the previous films, because this was a Mel Gibson story originally. This was going to have a certain amount of time after Thunderdome, but for whatever reason, they just basically had to move on from Mel at the time. And which brings us to the cast. And the cast is very interesting in this film, as we've talked about with the two top stars. But let's get to this first one. Tom Hardy himself, Max Rokitansky. Kyle, what did you think about the recasting of Max?
You know, this is a role that I think Tom Hardy was actually perfect for. He fits. I mean, he feels like he is Mad Max, and I know there's been all kinds of speculation about the Mad Max character in this film, but I thought Tom Hardy was perfect casting in this case. He's always kind of had this look that he would fit in this world, and I think you know, Mad Max has never been one big on words, so that works really well for Tom Hardy in this case.
And Kevin, what do you think of Tom Hardy taking on Max?
I like Tom Hardy. I think that he's a great actor. I remember first coming across him as Shinzon in Star Trek Nemesis. And then, of course, he went on to do a lot bigger pictures. And I think he's a great actor. I love the intensity as Max. My only one critique would be I wish that he had a little bit more. I think of all the characters, his development I wanted to see a little bit more of. But then I started thinking about it. I'm like, how much more do you really need to know about Mad Max himself? I mean, we're all kind of going of what we know from the original films. So maybe that's why we didn't really get the backstory that we probably could have. We get these little flashbacks and these little things that kind of haunt him during the film, whether it's the little girl in the picture, you know, that he keeps seeing in his flashbacks or whatever it is. And, you know, obviously I wanted maybe a little bit more dialogue, because, you know, it seemed like we got more dialogue to a certain degree in the other films. But in this film, to me, it really belongs to Charlize Theron as Furiosa.
Yep. I agree. And I think that's the thing is with Tom, I think his performance and what we were given by George in the film from Max in the story, they're really going back to what Mel did maybe in Road Warrior, where there's only about probably 12, maybe 13 lines, and making it very minimalist. What do you think, Cole?
You know, it's something I've always kind of felt with the Mad Max films, and that's kind of what's always made them a little bit more interesting. So maybe more, maybe not the original Mad Max, but especially with Road Warrior and Thunderdome, was Max never felt like he was the main character, even though it was about, you know, it was about his story, but it was always felt he was there to kind of be, I guess, your point of view character, but the stories themselves were about the people around him. It was always more developing those characters and people around them. You really did, Max was not your point of emphasis per se, and you were looking at Max as kind of the guy who just falls into these situations and is along for the ride more than he is the main man in these films.
It's an interesting point. And as Kevin, as you said, Charlize really, I think, is the main character in this. I mean, to me, it should be called Furiosa, I think, this movie.
Yeah, Mad Max Furiosa. It's, you know, I think that when going into this film, we know who Mad Max is, or at least should be. And they really needed to highlight another character and this character's plight and the reason why she's doing what she's doing. And Mad Max just always seems to be that guy that comes into a situation to assist and be the good person to a certain degree and help fight the greater fight. And so we see that character and relationship develop between these two and him helping her out.
What do you think of Furiosa as a hero's journey, Cole?
You know, I think it's quite interesting because it's definitely a full journey for Furiosa. She goes full circle in this story from when we first are introduced to her, and then as we learn about her throughout the film and where it ends. And what I think is so great about Furiosa in this film is obviously such a strongly written character, but still has a sense of humanity. And that, I think, and Charlize Theron sold that so incredibly well. And I think that's really what made Furiosa stand out so much in a film that really, truthfully, at the end of the day, was lacking in its characters a lot of basic humanity in them.
I think it brings up something that we all as a team brought up on Beyond Thunderdome, is that Max regains some of his humanity through that story. And I think it's important that Fury Road is kind of like, if you look at the hero's journeys of both Max and of Furiosa, they're both going very similar stories where he's basically become an animal at the start of the film. He's an animal. And his journey is that he regains some of his humanity. And it's interesting that it is Furiosa that teaches him humanity.
Yeah, and, you know, that's a twist that's kind of been in really the last two Mad Max films a little bit too. It seems like, you know, in Road Warrior, he still has some of his humanity, but he kind of regains it by helping the people in Road Warrior, and in this same kind of thing with helping the kids in Thunderdome. But I think what makes this so unique in with Fury Road is you have such a more in-depth story than I think any of the other Mad Max films. I think you have the most developed Mad Max story in this, as, you know, you feel like you have a little bit more connection to this world and you understand it a little better, perhaps, than any of the other Mad Max films. Am I off base there, Kevin? What do you think?
No, not at all. And you made a good point about the humanity, because living in a wasteland like that can basically sap that from anyone. And we see that in these films, how humanity, these humans that probably were civilized at a certain point, kind of start to de-evolve, and because of how hard the world is, you have to become this animal that is willing to do anything that you can do to survive, and you forget everything that maybe you grew up with. And some of these people grew up in this environment, so they don't know what it's like to have this decent humanity. And I think that we see the humanity that Mad Max himself once knew when he was, you know, a loving husband and father. And it's someone like Furiosa and the people that she's helping that kind of opens his eyes to this, and he rediscovers that.
Without a doubt. Now, the next actor we're going to look at is Nicholas Holt, who's known, I suppose, for X-Men, where he plays Beast. Now, he plays the character Nux, who's, again, another character that is central to both Furiosa and to Max's story. So, Kev, what do you think of his performance in this as Nux? It's an interesting role.
Yeah, I liked him in this one. He starts to, you know, he's such a devoted, blindly devoted person of Immortan Joe and the War Boys. And then you start to see his character developed. And like I said in the beginning, that's what I love about this movie is you see all these characters get these little moments and his character gets to shine. And I've always been a big fan of his. I remember him from About a Boy. The one film other than the X-Men films I remember him was a movie called Warm Bodies. I remember him in that as well. I think he's a really, really good actor, and I've seen him in a lot of stuff, and I've liked everything that he's done, and I think that, you know, and by the way, another underrated film that he did not get a big release over here is a movie called Collide, and I highly recommend that you see that, because Ben Kingsley, I think, was in that, and he kind of plays a race car driver that is kind of gets sucked into you know, some crime, and it's a really good film. But I just like him. I think he's got a good on-screen presence, and I think that his movie career is just going to get bigger and bigger.
And Cole, what do you think of Nicholas's role in the film?
Well, first of all, I'm a big Nicholas Holt fan too. He's done so many movies I've liked. He did one that was a similar kind of, not, I don't want to say wasteland, but in the future and things aren't good, called The Young Ones. And that was an excellent film as well. But as far as him and Nux, again, this is one thing that you know, we get so wrapped up in the action of this film and we're so mind blown by what we see. But again, it's another great character moment where we see this character evolve through this film, and from this basically just blind, all cares about is the way the War Boys think and everything like that, to becoming kind of in his own way, rediscovering his own humanity and emotions. As, you know, he actually kind of falls for one of the brides and everything that goes on with him. And it's just it comes because of how he's treated by Furiosa, Max, and by the other people compared to how he would be in that environment with the War Boys. And it's one of those lessons where it's like, you know, sometimes you really truly are a product of your environment.
I agree. And one of the biggest products of the environment is Immortan Joe. That's right. Now, this is the literal god of the Citadel itself. Hugh Keyes Byrne, the one and only Toe Cutter, has returned, and like some other actors that have been in this series, return in other roles. And Hugh is a huge Australian actor with a legacy which goes right back, not just to Mad Max, but before that. And a lot of people might know him from also Salute of the Jugger, or otherwise known in the States,
Blood
of Heroes. That's right. Now, what's interesting about him is each time he's taken on a character, he takes on a completely different person. But the character acting he's done in this one, I think, is the strongest we've ever seen. The character itself is literally, I mean, again, it's a god-like figure, but we know that it's what it's come from. And if you read the actual graphic novel precedes the film, it actually shows you that this is basically a war veteran. He's gone through, I think they call it the gas wars or the fuel wars. After everything's basically wiped out, he gets the Citadel itself and knows that it's a position of power and sets out basically a religious kingdom for himself. But Hugh himself's a fantastic actor. He's been in Farscape as well and other series. But I want to get your thoughts on it, Kevin. What do you think of his role here? It's different than Toe Cutter, isn't it?
Definitely. Toe Cutter was a great villain, bad guy. I mean, that dude was just crazy, you know, and you have to be that type of character to lead those type of biker gangs, I guess, in those days. And but I tell you, man, his portrayal as Immortan Joe and the look of Immortan Joe just blew me away. When you have to have the bad guy, whatever is the antagonist of a movie, you want to give him a really cool, memorable look. I mean, we could look back on history on great bad guys, you know, like Darth Vader, you know, one of the most iconic ones, or the Kurgan in Highlander, you know, Immortan Joe. Oh my gosh. I got to give whole credit to the costume and production design, giving him this certain look and that kind of breathe, that mask that he has to breathe through, and that he's got these boils and stuff that's happening on him. Like a lot of the other people are suffering from this stuff. And you know, when you have to wear all of that and pull off a really kind of scary character at the same time, you got to give it to Hugh Keyes Byrne, for doing such a great job on this. And I remember after seeing Mad Max, I'm like, the first thing I think of, and Kyle, you may think of this too, is like, what kind of costume treatment are we going to see at Dragon Con the following year?
You know? Oh yeah.
And I remember seeing a couple people do a really good job dressing up, as Immortan Joe, as well as Furiosa and several other characters from the movie.
Yeah. No, this is one of those things that makes the whole Mad Max series so unique, is the iconic look of the villains. And it, you know, maybe not so much in the original, going back to the original film, but you look at Road Warrior, you look at Thunderdome, and the look and feel of the world that's created, but especially these villains. And then Immortan Joe, I mean, he's creepy, he's kind of disgusting, but yet he puts the fear of God of you in a way too. And that, I mean, and that, again, not only goes to credit to the actor, but the creative team for the design, the costuming team, the makeup, everything across the board. And it's just like, you don't even want to be in the same area as this guy, because he creeps you out that much. Even though he might not seem intimidating in a physical manner, there's just something about him you don't want to be around.
The thing that's scary about his character and portrayal is that he demands and exudes loyalty from all of his followers, just blind loyalty from the War Boys. They want to fight for him. They want to die for him. And to have that type of power and whatever you want to say, iron fist hold on, you know, your tribe or whatever it is, the people that you're leading, it really shows the power that he has in this wasteland, that these War Boys are willing to get these tattoos and look a certain way and to basically just die for him and for his cause.
I think it speaks very much to the power in this case of, you don't necessarily have to be a physical thing in this type of world because people are so beaten down. But if you have a mental ability and charisma like Immortan Joe has, that can take over people's minds because people are in such a weakened condition as it is. And I think that's a lot of what happened in here with how he came to power in Fury Road.
And we should say too, that as those War Boys, you know, have that loyalty with him, they're willing to die, not only as going into battle for him, but also they're given tumors, actual tumors, which actually puts them on death row. Because at the end of the day, what they're looking to do is to go into Valhalla, to heaven, and basically go to the world of peace for this guy. So they're fanatics. But the fact that it's an often neglected part of that story that people don't know is that when you see those little boils that are on the shoulders of Nux, for example, and he names them, those are actually to show that, yes, he is half dead already. So one of the sons of Immortan Joe is none other than Rictus Erectus himself, Nathan Jones, the Australian wrestler slash action tough guy. He's a massive guy, an amazing actor. And I think you've probably seen him in a lot of films. One of the big ones, A-grade films you've probably seen him in before this, is Troy. He lasts about 30 seconds at the start when he gets speared by Brad Pitt's character Achilles. You remember that one, Kyle?
You know what? I do remember that. I didn't realize that was Nathan Jones. The sad part is I actually remember Nathan Jones when he was here in the States wrestling for WWE. It did not go well. Let me just put it that way.
Do you remember Kevin as well?
I remember that scene vividly in Troy because, you know, you have he was so huge and big, and, you know, it was, you know, let's put up our two best warriors. And then Brad Pitt, knowing the anatomy of the human body so well, he knew exactly where to put Slice's sword in to take him down. And I thought that was a pretty cool scene. But other than that, I I have not, I don't watch wrestling, so I don't know his background, but he made an impression for sure in this film.
Without a doubt. Now, we won't go through all the cast, but we've also got Rosie Huntington-Whiteley as the Splendid, who's one of the war wives, basically. We've got Riley Keough, Zoe Kravitz, that's the daughter of Lenny Kravitz, Abby Lee, Courtney Eaton as well. Now, of course, they play such a big part in the story itself too, because as we don't get much exposition out of Max, they're talking about the world of Max as we go along. Now, Kev, did you enjoy that part of when they're in the war rig, when they're literally, you know, they're getting battle after battle, but at the same time, basically the war brides are talking about what's happening in the world?
Yeah, it's interesting to see how tight this group was, and watching the special features, you have these actresses talking about their experience on the set and how they all kind of bonded, and you know, that basically their characters were slaves to be breeders for Morton Joe and his select few, and they obviously have a reason of why they want to escape. And Zoe Kravitz, of course, we know being the daughter of Lenny Kravitz. And of course, recently she has been in the new Fantastic Beasts film. She's got a very crucial role in that film as well, and she was really good in that. I like the casting. I like the look of these girls, and that Furiosa's determination to set them free.
Definitely, Kyle. What are your thoughts on the story as it is getting told in the truck by this amazing cast?
You know, again, this is one of these things that's actually a kind of a Mad Max tradition where the other characters are the narrators for you. And again, I think that's something George Miller has always done very well, but it works extremely well here because you're talking about one here. You have these absolutely beautiful women who are in this horrific situation, and you're getting this viewpoint from these women who have been through hell and back because of what they've had to go through and what they know that they were going to be made to do or have already had to do. And it brings a sympathetic dynamic to the film. And you really want to see these women get their freedom.
Without a doubt. Now, some of the other Australian actors that George brought into the production, very famous out here, not so much internationally, is John Howard as the people eater. I mean, the roles are the more exciting thing, I think. Like the bullet farmer, played by Richard Carter. And for you out there that grew up in Australia, you're going to love this one. Angus Sampson played the organic mechanic. Now, Angus Sampson is known for out here a show called Recovery, which was, as we grew up through the 90s and early 2000s, a lot of that generation had him on there as a character called the Enforcer, who used to rock up on the show and basically stir up the celebrities and stuff like that. It was like a morning chat show. But what's even more interesting is he looks like a veteran podcaster of Star Wars. He looks like Jedi Jones. Now, one of the greatest roles is the guitarist of the Doof Warrior, played by Iota. Now, this is such a – and I know Matt Clifton will want to be talking about this when he's on the next show. This is one of the most central parts of this is this amazing array of vehicles. And then all of a sudden we have this platform, speakers all over the place, and a bungee diving guitarist. Now, isn't this the most iconic thing in the chase scenes, Kev?
There's a scene that's referred to in the special features. The actor that you just spoke of, that was the mechanic, I'm forgetting his name. What's his name again?
Angus Sampson.
He's talking about this particular scene that you first are introduced to the Doof Warriors, rig, and you see the camera sweep past other vehicles, come up on the backside of the vehicle where you got the drummers, you know, doing this war tribe drum beat, and then the camera zooms around to the front, and you see this crazy looking dude on this guitar with flamethrower on it, and he's attached to it by these bungee cords. This is probably one of the most iconic vehicles in this movie and kind of just sums up, you know, what this movie is all about when you see the visuals of this character and this Iota character. And I was looking him up, and he's an Australian performing artist, and he made his theatrical debut in Hedwig and the Angry Itch, which I know was based on a movie years ago. And he just looks so cool. I remember I got like a T-shirt with him on. I even got a a toy that had his image on it and stuff. When you think about making cars for this type of movie, it was just genius to come up with this kind of vehicle that doesn't really serve any doesn't serve any tactical purpose. Adam's holding up the Funko Pop version of the Doof. But it's kind of like, you know, back in the old days when people would go into war, you would have the people on the drums or the trumpets. Well, you have this Doof warrior with his guitar and, you know, all these martial stacks in the back or whatever it is that's providing the amplification, and this tribal beat that is just providing the storming into battle sort of thing, you know?
This is brilliant. Kyle, your thoughts?
I'm curious because, Kevin, I think this is going to resonate with you. The first time you see the Doof Warrior, and it's actually in the trailer for Fury Road, all I got was the feeling is like, oh, shouldn't this be in an issue of Heavy Metal?
Yeah, oh yeah.
I mean,
oh yeah, that's definitely out of Heavy Metal, the magazine, the adult illustrated fantasy magazine that started in the 70s and still continues today.
It's one of the most amazing visuals, I think, of recent movie history. And the fact he like Kevin said, you've got the stacks of speakers, you've got the drum players, you got him on the flame throwing guitar. And it's Mad Max. And Mad Max has always drawn you in with its unique looks. And I mean, Fury Road is the most visual of all the Mad Max films. And I think when you bring up Fury Road, the two things people talk about are Charlize Theron and the Doof Warrior. And it's really, really that more than anything, because it's such a powerful visual that just sticks in your head.
Really does. Yeah, some of the other in the cast, we won't go too into it, but we got Megan Gale, the famous supermodel, as the Valkyrie that we see later in the film. We've also got the late now, unfortunately, he's passed away, but Quentin Keenan, who played the other son of Immortan Joe, Corpus Colossus. And Quentin was a staple of Australian TV all through the 80s and 90s. Used to be on a lot of shows and stuff like that, and always enjoyed seeing him. He's very, very positive person. And we also have Australian martial artist extraordinaire. Now, for you guys, particularly over in the States, you'll remember him from a lot of the, Hong Kong action films at the time. Richard Norton's his name. He's a famous Zendo Kai and karate specialist out here in Australia, who is very good friends with the one, the only Chuck Norris.
Chuck Norris. Yeah, wasn't he the main bad ninja guy in the Octagon?
Correct, he was.
Yeah.
And he had that really dreary mustache, and the scene goes, righto, all you guys are trying out for our little ninja team, and you got to sign the contract. And of course, Chuck would not sign it. And he goes, what's the matter? Where you going, mate? Where you going? And then, of course, the little fight erupted between them. But he's a longtime friend and somebody that I think Chuck's always been there for, and vice versa when it comes to careers and friendship in martial arts industry. Richard's very, very popular out here in Australia.
Yeah, he's got an extensive career doing stunts. He's a very striking man, too. He's very, very good looking. And I know he's been doing a lot of recent acting as well, a lot of episodic television. He did Spartacus recently, too. He's been around for quite a long time, and also, you know, born in Melbourne, Victoria.
He's also coordinated a lot of fights, including he was the main fight coordinator on the Suicide Squad film.
Yep, and Ghost in the Shell, he did some stuff there as well.
Now, you guys might remember a certain film Jackie Chan did back in 1993, where he basically played a spy-like character, kind of a little James Bond-style character. It was called City Hunter, and there's a scene in there where you have him jump into a arcade machine, and we had a Street Fighter 2 session there where he became about five or six of the characters along with Gary Daniels. But the lead villain was played on a cruise ship by the one, the only Richard Norton. So you get to see him go toe-to-toe with a number of the amazing action stars of 1993. And I hate to say it, I've lost my copy of the movie, and it pains me. I gave it to somebody I used to work with for a lend, and then they just skipped town, never saw him again. And it's one
movie. What movie was that called for Jackie? What Jackie Chan movie was that?
1993's City Hunter.
I don't know if I ever saw that.
Well, let's bring up this. This is the photo of the case, if you ever see it. So,
I see which one. I'm wondering if it went under a different name here in the States, but okay, I recognize that. That's cool.
Yeah, now, again, that was another one of the films produced by Golden Harvest back then. But, again, it showed that Richard can not only do the stunts and the action, but, you know, he's got the charisma to do a fun villain. And it was very much, I think, I suppose a stab at those Bond-like villains where they tell you all their plans and they still get done by Jackie Chan. So quite an amazing role. So let's get into, now that we've talked about the cast, we're going to look at some of the themes in the film itself. And one of the biggest in the series, not just Fury Road, is survival. As we see at the start of the movie, once the credits are over with, it jumps straight into the man himself, Tom Hardy, as Mad Max, literally eating a lizard to survive in the desert.
A two-headed lizard.
A two-headed lizard. That's right. It's a mutated one. But really, it's the theme in this series. Humanity has been lost to survival. So really, if you look at what we know as humanity today, they don't have the emotions. They don't have all the inbuilt morality. Instead, survival is key. So when Miller's designed this world, you do what you can to survive. All laws and everything are gone completely. And I think that's one of the things he looks at in this landscape, not just as an Australian film, but this is very much like the American frontier, the Westerns, where there was no laws. You had to do what you needed to keep your family safe. What do you think, Kyle?
Yeah, I mean, survival's always been the main theme of Mad Max, I think. You know, when you're talking about this wasteland, and it's, to me, one of the more interesting things is the fact that even in you go back to the original Mad Max, before things go really bad, Mad Max is a police officer. He's there to try to create order in this chaos. And one of the things is, and I think it's kind of the sad theme of the Mad Max films, is that Mad Max is always just drawn back into the chaos. He can't escape it. And yet it's probably his time as being a police officer that keeps that little spark of humanity left in him that keeps getting pulled back out when he's right on the edge of just completely, totally going over the cliff into the chaos.
Mm. And Kevin, what do you think about this extension of, you know, I think it's a bit more barbaric, this survival in this film, don't you think?
Oh, definitely. It's we get a chance to see the world. Because what I'm, even though it's not a sequel to the original Mad Max trilogy, what I like about it is that you could almost kind of see this definitely taking place after the events of Road Warrior, maybe even after, Beyond Thunderdome, even though he does have his vehicle in the beginning of this film. You see, you know, that it's, the world is definitely de-evolving to barbarism to its highest degree, and you definitely see the way that's done with the way Immortan Joe rules with his iron fist and keeps the power over his followers, and keeping water at its premium and stuff like that. So that's what I liked about this film and the look of it. And you know, I remember one of the things I was at first a little disappointed. I'm like, oh, it wasn't filmed entirely in Australia. They filmed a lot of these scenes in Africa. But when you look at the backdrop of what Africa and Namibia, where they filmed it, provided, it really lent an awesome visual representation of what the wasteland would look like in a post-apocalyptic world.
Mm. I agree. Now, Kyle, one of the biggest elements in this film, as we talked about with the cast, is, of course, I think the dramatic center of the film itself, or, you know, if we look at the heroic center itself, is Charlize Theron's Furiosa. I think, without a doubt, it takes into Joseph Campbell's hero's journey big time. We see somebody who's faced with a challenge. She wants to save people. She wants to get people into freedom. And there's a number of hurdles as any heroes go through, whether it's Star Wars, Star Trek, any of those great series or superheroes. But what I think about this is really brought to the, this sort of environment and this kind of film one of the strongest female heroes we've ever had.
Furiosa goes right up there, as far as I'm concerned, with a Sarah Connor or an Ellen Ripley, as far as strong women in science fiction. And, you know, I almost have to put her right at the top of the list. I mean, this was just such a powerful performance. And, you know, Charlize Theron is probably one of the greatest actresses of our generation. I mean, we've seen her do so many different films. I always go back to her performance as Monster, where in that movie Monster, where you wouldn't even know that was Charlize Theron unless you had read the credits. But in this, she has such an energy and such an edge to her, and she never is weak in the film, even when it's moments where she should, where you feel like she's letting her emotions out a little bit, but it never comes across as weakness. It still feels like she's got this just constant strength, and she's going to do whatever she needs to do to get these women free and get and gain freedom. And this character, I mean, I would almost be interested just in how much the world has changed in the few years since this film came out. How would this, I mean, as well received as Furiosa was just a few years ago, how would she be received in today's world, where even just in a short period of time, women's empowerment has become such a more front and center thing? That this, I mean, Furiosa would be rejoiced even more so than she was just a few years ago.
Mm. I agree. Kevin, what do you think? You know, say 2018 had been the release date of this film. Now, where women's empowerment is such an amazing thing right now, they're getting stronger and stronger. I think this would have resonated even stronger.
Yeah, I agree with that. This is, and I liked your comparison, Kyle, with like the Sarah Connor and Ellen Ripley type thing too. She definitely exudes that. And, you know, to me, I got to be honest with you, I think she outshines the character of Max as the action hero of this film. And she even has to, you know, she doesn't even have a left arm. You know, she has to have a prosthetics to do that, but she uses it to her best ability, and even saves Max's life at the end of that one scene towards the end of the film. But, you know, that's what I love about Charlize, is that she is probably one of the best actors out there right now. But what I give her credit for is not just, you know, her Oscar-winning role in Monster or this type of action hero that we're seeing in Mad Max, but she's also, and of course, if you see Atomic Blonde, you know that she definitely has the physic capability of kicking some major on-screen butt as a female action hero. But you know, I really got to give her a lot of credit for her comedic chops, because being able to be funny is something that I think a lot of people don't really give dramatic actors credit for. Obviously, a lot of it's hard to do comedy. It really is. And she did the film A Million Ways to Die in the West, that was the Seth MacFarlane vehicle. And what's funny is that she's wearing a wig in that film because she had just come off the set of doing this film. Yet she was able to play a completely different character, be extremely funny, and I love her for that, and I think she's great.
Agreed. And one of the other big themes in these movies, of course, are usually, particularly in a Road Warrior-style setting, is things like vengeance. And I think vengeance itself, or revenge tales, are key to this Western-like fantasy that is set into these tales. You know, a lot of the characters are hard done by at the start of it, and they're facing insurmountable odds, whether it's people like Toe Cutter, where Mad Max has to literally find the guy and force his case, get justice for the death of his family. I think this is very similar to Furiosa's journey. She wants to not only be free, but she wants to see a certain amount of vengeance done for being, you know, taken away and kidnapped by this society to become an imperator, and basically lose all sense of family and friendship from where she came from. And I think part of that is also losing that world, because when she returns to it, spoiler warning, it's no longer there, is it, Kev?
It's no longer what?
It's no longer there. When she returns, it's there, but it's wasted away.
Yeah, it fell by the wayside of what the apocalyptic world started doing and taking over, and you know, whether it was people from her tribe, because that's what she said. She said she was part of a tribe, have either died off or what have you, you know, because her mom had passed away shortly after she was abducted. And she comes across these ladies that are what's left of that area, and it doesn't look like anything that it did before. And I think that's actually one of the most powerful scenes in the film, because you see her take off her prosthetic from her arm and just drop it and drop down to her knees and scream in sorrow and agony. And it's a very powerful scene. And that scene's important too, because Max sees what this has done to her. And I think that was one of the defining moments that he decides to definitely stick with her to the very end, because even though she allows him and gives him a motorcycle for him to take off, he then decides he comes back to their caravan and stops him and saying, look, I'm here to help you. Not in so many words, of course.
Yeah, that would be more words than Mad Max ever said, but
yes.
No, I agree with a lot with what you said, and you know, I think that scene that we're talking about is the scene where you see Max kind of reconnect with his humanity completely. And when that's what brings him back to help these people. And you know, again, this film is Furiosa's film. It's not a Mad Max film. It is Furiosa's film. And that's what makes this so special about this, because nobody knew going into this, and then you have this, and that's what everybody was talking about. I mean, it was either the visuals or it was Furiosa, and 99% of the people initially, it was all about Furiosa, and you know, that's what makes this film so amazing.
Oh, I agree. One of the other things that's not in the notes I made for today's session, but one of the things I think that we are all talking about here is that heroes face hard truths, and they have to face those truths and their own recollections of what they remember. So whether it's talking to, them about their family or about their past, what made them go on their journey. We can see it in Star Wars with characters like Rey, I suppose. We can see it with Batman having to face that, you know, at the end of the day, he is different than his father. You know, his father was trying to do a certain amount of justice as well, but he doesn't have the willpower that Batman has due to events. And I think that happens too with what you see here, as she remembers in the novelty of her mind what her previous life was. And I think we all do that with nostalgia as children. You know, we remember, you know, whether it's a cartoon or a movie that we saw. And how many times do we revisit that? In this case, at our age now, a couple of decades later, and that nostalgia doesn't quite give you what you remembered. You know, it's something else. It's a different thing. That hard truth also propels your hero's journey further, and I think that's what's so strong about these mythic tales. So the film itself, of course, faced quite a few insurmountable challenges. And in the early days of Mad Max 4, George Miller basically reacquired the rights to it in 1995. So we have had it basically in production, or in some ways of getting it made, from as early as 1995, where at that stage Mel Gibson was involved in the film. So it would have been a fourth in that series at the time. But due to not just rights and different things coming up, different events, changing the budget and stuff like that, Miller couldn't really act on it till about 2006. And we saw that the plot and some of the details get to a point where they need to really sketch out the story itself, literally sketch out the story. So he made literally a comic book, if you like. And this story grew through a comic book. And I think, Cole, you'll probably agree with me here, if you made it in an anime form, this would be one of the most vivid, because it really is, at the end of the day, it's like a big comic book.
Yeah, very much. If this would have been an animated style of thing, this would have even been more outrageous. But you know, there's something else I want to add to this too, Adam, that you're talking about. I think it's almost better it took longer, because I don't know if Mel Gibson as Mad Max in this movie works as well as Tom Hardy.
That's a good point.
I wanted to touch on that animated thing that you were talking about. When I was watching the special features on this, George Miller and crew definitely mapped this out, storyboards to a certain degree, and if you want to call it kind of like a I guess an anime, you know, and then it was the challenge that they had was to try and bring these wonderful images on paper into the production meeting and bring it to life. And they talk about that specifically, that in the first making of special feature that is on the Blu-ray or DVD that you have. And you see this meeting room with all with the director and everyone around this table, and you see this wall filled with all of these storyboards and the fantastic art that this story was put together.
Without a doubt. One of the interesting things about the series, you know, Miller's always, looked at, various influences when it comes to where this all comes from. Obviously, this is the Western, but, he's been known to cite Akira Kurosawa for inspiration with the franchise as well. And I think Kurosawa is interesting because Kurosawa was influenced by Westerns, you know, by John Ford and things like that. And it's funny how that comes back around as well with the American cinema after Kurosawa then being influenced by his films to make things like Magnificent Seven. So, again, it's sort of just keeping that flow going. But the film itself was also one that changed locations away from Australia. And when they decided on a location in November 2011, it looks like Broken Hill was just not going to work because the heavy rains, a lot of flowers were growing through the desert itself, so basically it was too fertile. So they changed to the, as you mentioned, Kevin, Namibia, African location. And they looked at others. They looked at Chile, looked at Tunisia, Azerbaijan as well. But Namibia really gave that broken down fallout feel to the desert.
I wanted to comment on that because it just kind of came to me recently when I was rewatching this film. When you look at the first Mad Max film, and then you also look at Road Warrior, and you have to assume that this film, even though it's not a direct sequel, it takes place after Road Warrior to a certain degree, okay? But what's interesting about it is that when you look at Road Warrior, there's still some signs of recent normal, I guess, civilization, because you see actual paved road. In this movie, you don't see paved road. So therefore, maybe that's why they had to look for, not to put Australia down, but maybe you had to look for something a little more post-apocalyptic than Australia could provide.
You're too modern, Australia.
I mean, if you look at Australia and what it's provided, there's still some paved road out there to a certain degree, unless you get into the middle of the country, which apparently no one's yet been to.
Well, but, I don't know. We should ask Ryan Safley about that.
But
yeah,
I know Ryan has to drive 6 hours just to see a movie. When you think about it, they had to find a different location because when you look at these chase scenes, these two iconic chase scenes, they go on for so long, and they have to provide a background that doesn't give anything any resemblance to any recent civilization. You have to show where you're at in this world after the decay, after the wars or whatever that it is. And you know, when you see how they film this, I mean, there was so much practical effects, but there was also so much practical filming location that the only special effects they really added was removing safety harnesses and safety lines and then adding some different looks to the sky and some of the background. But when you look at the desert scenes here, that's all real. And that's really hard to find, especially for such a vast location and having to have these vehicles be in a back shot for such a long distance.
Without a doubt. So by the time of 2012, they started filming in Namibia. And it took place also at Potsill and Penrith Lakes in Sydney as well. But one of the great things about this is when they really went out there, the vehicles were all real, as you say, but there's a consistent and I think a very elegant look in the way that they designed those films. V8 being a religion, V8 was something they all looked towards. So the hot rods this time were really pushed to the point.
And I keep referring to the special features of the Blu-ray DVD. Make sure you guys check this out because there's one that actually covers the vehicles. And the fact that they built all of these vehicles a lot from scratch or from the shells of models of these cars, and you look at a Morton Joe's double stacked, was it Chevrolet or whatever it was put in there, and then you got like the Bigfoot style monster car as well. And, you know, and what's funny is, like, I remember being a little disappointed at the beginning of this film because you see Mad Max's Interceptor be taken out so quickly. But then you're treated to these wonderful other war machines that are put together. And then you see, like, an evolved version of his Interceptor as they kind of souped it up. and you
made
know,
it forward drive.
Yeah, and then you see those guys on those warriors that are on top of those poles that they use for boarding and stuff, and they're going back and forth, and they talk about those stunts as well. But that's one of the things why this movie pushed it over as one of my favorites, is because of the detail that they put into those vehicles. And I'm thinking, like, okay, so if they filmed this, the majority of these scenes in Africa, I gotta say, I just can only imagine them transporting all of these vehicles to this desert location. It had to be a task in itself.
Folks, if you check out Mad Max Wiki, so you go on madmax.com, fandom.com, there's a specific page that actually takes you to where you can look at each of the vehicles, how they were broken down. And as Kevin said, you can see all these vehicles. Like, perfect example, as you say, is the remake of the Interceptor into the Razor Cola, which is literally like a chrome version of the Mad Max car, four-wheel drive and everything. You've got the double Chevrolet, the Giga Horse, in there, which is, of course, the great car that we see at the end of the film, taken over by Max himself. And we also have the War Rig, which is a General M814 People Eaters limousine as well, as in there. We've also got the Chevrolet that Nux used. It's a window coupe 1934 hot rod. But I think one of the great ones is the Bullet Farmer's Hohenho Ripsaw, that tank-like vehicle, which is...
I love the Bullet Farmer. Oh. Not only his look himself, but I love that kind of tank car that he has. That is a great vehicle.
Imagine that going across the beach head at Byron Bay. Wouldn't that be crazy? Kyle, what did you think of the cars?
Oh, again, these are some of the most amazing vehicle designs I've seen in years. And it's something that's, again, this is why Fury Road works, because it takes what has always worked in Mad Max films. You've always had great vehicles, unique-looking vehicles. And in this case, it was every unique vehicle that I think George Miller ever wanted, plus they were all on steroids.
Yeah.
I mean, even the most basic vehicle had a look to it. And, you know, that's, you talked earlier about V8 being a god and everything like that. And that's one of the things that's always been kind of magical with the Mad Max films too, is the role of cars and the role of vehicles in Mad Max, who are, sometimes these vehicles are just as much their own characters as the human beings in the
Well said, Kyle. Yeah.
So without a doubt, there's so many vehicles in this film that are just a character upon themselves. You know, whether we're talking about the Doof Warriors vehicle, a Morton Joe's vehicle, even Mad Max's car, or even the War Wagon. I mean, so the vehicles themselves, especially in Fury Road, are their own characters.
I don't think of them as vehicles in the sense of how they're portrayed. I think they're the weapons. It's kind of like if you're a gunslinger in the West, your six gun was your weapon. In this universe of this type of Western, this post-apocalyptic environment, your big gun is your car. So the bigger you've got, the better it is. Wouldn't you say?
Yeah, definitely. Okay. Yeah. And it's nice because you see Nicholas Hoult's character of that roadster, the way it's done, and then how he's able to set up his hashtag blood bag, Mad Max, in the front. that's just, and then in the back of it, you got room for his buddy Slit or whatever his character's name is to wreak havoc and everything. I mean, it's just every one of those vehicles was fantastic and served its own purpose for its owner.
Now, Kyle, I've got to ask you about this one. Now, your previous films had Dean Semler as a cinematographer. And we have a new one here where we have a, cinematographer by the name of John Seale, who came out of retirement to actually do this film. Do you think the film is, you know, taking the elements of Dean Semler and portraying that, or is it even more vivid?
Oh, it's even more vivid. This film is gorgeous. The cinematography in this film. There was two movies that came out during this around the same time. One was in the summer. One was early. I believe it was earlier in the year. It might have been later. That just to change my perspective of modern cinematography, it was this film and it was The Revenant. And this film, just the angles in they use in the chase and how they film these chases, the way that they use the colors of their surroundings, whether it was the sky, the grounds that they were driving on, everything. This is almost a near impossible movie to even film if you think about it. I mean, just how, and to get the shots they got, I mean, this is by far one of the greatest films cinematography wise. There should be a class on this film.
I don't remember his name, forgive me, but he was one of the lead stuntmen, and he had performed in the past Mad Max. I think it was Road Warrior or something like that. And I don't remember if it's – I don't remember his name.
Guy Norris.
Is that who it is? Because he's kind of like an older guy, graying hair, is kind of growing long. Okay, good. It was – what was really cool about him being interviewed in the special features is that he talks about how – there was a certain stunt where they wanted to achieve one of the vehicles turning over and doing a bunch of different flips because they wanted to get a certain shot. And what I liked about his mentality towards approaching this stunt was that he was the one that volunteered first and foremost to do it because he felt that not only he could do it right, but he didn't want to put the burden on anyone else of trying to figure out what his vision was for this particular stunt. And so he did it himself, and it was great because behind the scenes you see the stunt being done with all the cameras in certain locations to capture the shots. But then you see the aftermath of him getting out of the car safely, and then the cast and crew giving a round of applause and stuff like that. And there's also a great shot of George Miller in the tent with all of the cameras with when the war rig does its stunt and crashes, and he sees someone's head like sticking out a little too far, and he's like genuinely concerned, thinking that was the stunt driver, but instead it wasn't. It was the dummy that was put in there. But it was interesting to see that tension on the set and seeing to make sure that everything was done safely. And all credit to the stunt team in this and those guys that were the pole warriors, the ones that were like swinging back and forth, and the how they got around to that, where they went to Cirque du Soleil performers to get their input on how to do that properly.
It's amazing. I think one of the great things about that is we've never seen stunts like that before. And that's one of those visions we saw in the trailers, and you didn't know whether it was, oh, that's got to be CGI. We all thought that. But when you finally see that the stunt team that worked on this really got it down pat, they figured how to do it and do it in such a way that it really pushed it. One of the great things too about this film is the amazing soundtrack. And the work done by Junkie XL, the Dutch composer, is to me today, I've still got on my phone as a ringtone the Fury Road soundtrack, that dun, 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 that drum beat, the driving synth behind it as well. I think it's amazing. He'd worked previously on one of the 300 films, but I have to say, this is truly like Blade Runner. It's one of those soundtracks you can't get out of your head. What do you reckon, Cole?
Yeah, no, I agree. The soundtrack is very powerful in this film, and especially when you have that soundtrack going within these chase scenes. And it's one of these things, and you know, the more we talk about this film and the more I go back and remember it, there's so much about this film, and I remember that what makes it so well is every piece fits. Sometimes you have these films and there's always that one piece that doesn't fit, and yet everything fits in here, and the music especially. It fits just perfectly in that puzzle that makes this film so great. And, it's just, it's hard to get your mind wrapped around how well this film works. And then, you know, you put in that soundtrack and you listen to that soundtrack, or you're watching the film, and you get so pulled in by every little element, and the music helps so immensely with that.
Yeah, Kevin, what do you reckon? Is this the ultimate driving soundtrack?
You know what's funny? When I first saw the film, the music didn't really set in on the impact that it made because of the visuals of the film. But when I did a rewatch, I realized actually how important the soundtrack was, adding to the intensity of the scenes and the moments that these people were in, and how well it kind of became a secondary character. Because if you watch this, I mean, when you watch some of these scenes and you put it on mute, it's you start to realize how important that music and that soundtrack is, and it definitely is a driving type of song or soundtrack, especially if you want to get like get a ticket or something.
It's amazing. Now, the film was released with a classification of PG-13 in test screenings and an R-rated version. And luckily, Warner Brothers went for the R rating. And overseas, obviously, over here in Australia, we got it as an MA release. Now, the film, I think, as gratuitous as it is, does it deserve to really have an R rating, do you think?
I think it does, because it adds a little bit more grit to it. You know, and you know, it's not like it was R-rated for nudity. You know, we didn't get that. It was R-rated for violence. And I think that if you really have to sell this world, you really have to go that deep and show how hard that it is and how violent it is out there. You know, if it would have gone with a PG-13 rating, I think there would have been a few scenes and maybe some language that was cut out of it. And I still think it would have been a good film. But having a few extras of these scenes that show you how brutal it is out there with some of the violence and some of the death scenes, I'm glad they kind of went that direction.
What do you think, Cole? Do you reckon they made the right call there?
Oh, absolutely. I think if you go with a PG-13 rating, you neuter this film. Because I think what you'd end up doing is, like Kevin said, you take out that little extra grit, that little extra element that puts this movie over the top. And I think what you end up having if you go try to go for the PG-13 rating is this film that's really good but missing that extra little something. And I think when you're talking about the world of Mad Max, you have to go with that R rating, because it is a hard world. It is a cruel world. And I think without having that extra violence and that's just showing the hardship of trying to survive in this world, you neuter a big part of the story, and you take away such a key element.
Definitely. Now, the film itself was released on the 7th of May 2015 worldwide and in the States at the TCL Chinese Theatre on the 14th of May 2015. And I have to say, word of mouth was the biggest thing, I think, more than any of the marketing they did on the experience of watching this film. And that's what drove a lot of the media releases here in Australia, worldwide as well. But I think one of the great things about this is that if you're in a decent cinema, whether it's IMAX or whether it's just we've got Max out here as well, which is just basically a bigger screen. A lot of those experiences were just being drawn into this environment. I mean, you were really propelled into it on those cinema screens. So, guys, where did you see it originally, and what was the experience like? I'll start with you, Kev.
I saw this, I think, on opening night. I think this is something that Kyle and I and all of us, cinema nerds wanted to see straight out of the bat. And it might have been on an IMAX too. I know I would have had it. I would have wanted to see it in its best offering visually. That I saw it opening weekend. I was all over seeing this film as soon as it came out. I was really excited for it.
Nice. Carl, where'd you sit?
Oh, I saw it opening night, and it was actually one of those kind of opening preview nights. Saw it on IMAX. Just stunning. And you walk out of that film, and it takes you a little bit to process everything you just saw, because this film was nothing that anybody expected. And I think it had a pretty good marketing campaign here in the States. I don't think that was an issue at all, because the ads were running constantly. But definitely word of mouth, especially the word of mouth about Charlize Theron's performance, really propelled a lot of people to go see this film who I don't think normally would have gone to see this film.
I think you made a very good point there. And I think that is, we were going in expecting something, and then I think we got, not only did we get something more, we got something more fulfilling as cinema goers as well. Now, the story writers on the film and George Miller himself decided to flesh out some of the story a little bit more in comic form. And we got a series of four comics called Mad Max Fury Road, which I collected myself in a trade paperback. Now, it covers Nux, it covers Furiosa, covers Mad Max, and you also get a background in the story of Immortan Joe. What's great about that is that story alone actually sets up how this part of the universe works. With the Mad Max story, you actually get to see a proper flashback, and you get to see retold in this reboot the issues of Mad Max 1. You get to see him as a police officer, main force patrol. You get to also see him as the Road Warrior storyline. And believe it or not, you get to see on the map where Thunderdome is. Two men enter, one man leaves in this environment, which is just fantastic. Have you guys had a chance to read the comic?
I have not, actually. I'm actually kind of fascinated to learn. I didn't know this came out. I don't collect comics like I did back in the day, but I'm kind of curious about this now because this movie did a great job world building, so it's nice to know that the comics did the same, apparently.
I remember these comics coming out, and I believe I read one of them. I haven't read the whole series, but I do remember being very impressed with the additional adding they did to the Mad Max world, and it made it really a lot more cohesive in a way. The comic worked as a very good idea. If I remember correctly, though, one of the things, the knocks on that comic was because it was a licensed comic movie based off a movie property, it did kind of get the typical movie property treatment from a comic, and you didn't have the greatest artistic team on it.
No, that's right. Now, the home media of the release itself, you got a number of different versions on Blu-ray, DVD, digital copy. All those ones came out in different versions. I think I've got about four copies of Fury Road in different variations. But it came out in Australia in, I think it was late August 2015 on Blu-ray. And to watch it on home cinema is another thing altogether. We were promised in that release a black and white version of the film also, but that came a little bit later in what we call the black and chrome edition of the film, which is what he preferred, apparently.
You'd actually be impressed with me, Adam, because on my recent trip to Australia, I actually purchased the Mad Max anthology, which included all of the Mad Max films, including the most recent one, of course. But yeah, the chrome version is one you'd have to buy separately, I think.
That's right. You can get it in the, I think it's the High Octane box set, which is the box set after the one you've got there. And but if you're going to do it, folks, get the High Octane, because you also get a brand new Road Warrior documentary that's never been released before in that release. But if you're going to get the Anthology Edition, you get a Mad Max documentary, which has Toe Cutter, has the rest of the team, has Mel Gibson in there, and you also hear about them revving up their motorcycles without exhaust pipes.
Gosh. Okay, I got a question for you, and I want to put this out to the listeners. I have not had a chance to see the black and white, was it Chrome Edition? Is that what they call it?
Black and Chrome, yeah.
And I see the appeal for that, because I think also it's kind of become a thing now. Logan did it as well. They have their black and white version. But I haven't watched it yet, but I want to ask you if you've seen it. And Kyle, maybe you can answer too. I don't know if you've seen it either. But to me, one of the things that's really impressive with this film is actually the color. And so I'm kind of like, do I really want to watch that compared to what I've seen originally? Because there's some really great color visuals in this film. Even when the girls get to the location that they think is the home of Furiosa, and they're sitting at nighttime, and there's this beautiful sky, and you see the stars and stuff. But does it take away at all, or does it add anything new to the experience of watching this film?
Yeah, real quick, Adam. I just want to echo. I agree with Kevin on this, because the color was so vividly outstanding. And to me, this is the kind of movie you want to have that color. Where, like, when they did the black and white version of Wolverine, because Wolverine had kind of a noir type feel to it, it worked. But with Mad Max, I'm not sure. So I am curious on your take on this, Adam.
So when I first heard that he was going to do that, I saw that little spiel he talked about how he was doing Road Warrior, and he took that black and white print of Road Warrior and gave it to, I think it was the composer at the time, Brian May. and they're talking about, you know, how to do the soundtrack to it. And he was taking away this sort of almost alien look to what he had filmed, because it almost feels completely removed from Mad Max. It's that hard. It looks more harsher than that environment. Now, the problem with Fury Road is color palette is such a big part of what the cinematography was. That experience was those amazing visuals, not just the chrome look, but that beautiful desert. It was an alien landscape to what we know as, a landscape today, because it's such, a vibrant look from the fallout itself. But when you take that away, one of the things Miller says is some things work when you grade it back to black and white, and some things don't. But one of the striking things for me is that scene, watching Black and Chrome, where you see Furiosa, everything's happened to her, she's gone home and realized it's not there anymore. And you see her silently cry out in the desert itself. That scene in Black and Chrome is even more intense because of the black and white visuals. So there's something about it. It is a Mad Max film that's harder, tougher, because it looks even more degraded from our society. So it's, to me, a harsher view, but I don't think it works as strong as the color palette that they had. So Black and Chrome is an interesting idea. Do I think it's as good as Fury Road? No. But I think it's a must watch because it really shows the harshness of this other world.
That's good to hear. I mean, I'm still curious. I do want to see it. I do want to pick it up.
Definitely. One of the things I think, too, is that, you know, we've had, as you say, Logan done this way. We've had a number of other films. But, I'm somebody that watches a lot of old film as well, going back to Kurosawa and, any great film like that that has come from black and white. And you can see that with that, they've really had to look at how to frame shots in such ways. And Fury Road carried that tradition, whether it's with color or without. And I think, again, it's because of the use of long lenses and stuff like that too. So, but we're coming to the end of the show, folks. So we're going to look at our final thoughts on this film. And as I said, we're going to do another episode, which is going to be you, the listeners, what you thought about this series. And we're also going to have some very close friends of the podcast and a Phantom podcast on to have a chat about their thoughts as well. So before we finish up, Kyle, what are your thoughts on this film?
You know, I remember when the Oscar nominations came out for this year and Mad Max Fury Road was on it. And at first I was a little shocked. And I think more than because anything, this was the kind of film that there was no way the Academy would have looked at in prior years. You know, we had Lord of the Rings, Return of the King win it. And most people consider that win kind of a full spectrum for Peter Jackson, recognizing all three films. This film is that powerful of a performance by Charlize Theron, and this film is one of the most perfectly made films of my lifetime. And the aspect of the cinematography, with the message it portrays, the performances in it, and you wouldn't think you would get that from Mad Max, but this is a piece of film history, and this is a film that's going to be taught in film classes in the future. And this is a film that people are going to go back and reference as maybe one of the greatest films of all time when you put it together as a whole, because this is one of those films that I would call a perfect film. There's not much fault to find in this film. And that's what makes this stand out so much. And, you know, it covers so many different topics, so many different themes, and yet you get yourself so lost in it. And into this world that you see in Fury Road and these performances. And when the film is over, it takes you a couple of minutes to come out of it. And that is the magic of film. And that's this film represents everything that is about the magic of watching a movie and getting lost in it.
And Kevin, I've got to ask you the tougher question. Are you ready for this one? So, was this the greatest film of 2015?
I'm having trouble remembering what else came out that year. Wasn't that Awakens? Also the release of Star Wars Force Awakens?
It was, yeah.
Yeah.
Which
yeah.
You saw 34 times, didn't you?
At least 30 times in the theater, yes. I think when you look at the films that stand the test of time, I think that this film does. Because as of late, I think I've seen this film over the last year, you know, definitely more than Star Wars Force Awakens. But I think this is one of those films that as you finish watching it, you want to see more. And you want to see where these characters and where Mad Max is going to go in this world. And I know there's some legal issues going on with you know, the rights or the profits of this film and the franchise going forward that may put a damper on that future plans of any sequels to this. But I think this movie will stand the test of time and visually, because there's certain movies that when you look back on, they don't seem dated. You know, like you could say that for like Raiders of the Lost Ark. You look back, it doesn't feel dated. It feels like it could have came out last year. This is one of those films, I think, that you will look at and go, you know, this could feel like it could dump it. It could premiere as a brand new movie in any decade, and so that's why I think it will stand the test of time.
Real quick, Kevin, I just want to throw out, I'm looking at the list of 2015 movies. Here's some of the other movies that came out in 2015: The Martian, Star Wars: The Force Awakens, the first Sicario film, The Revenant, Spotlight, Jurassic World came out, Creed came out, Spectre came out, Avengers: Age of Ultron, Black Mass, Ant-Man. So you had a Fast and Furious movies, which was those are always big. So this was a very packed year in film.
I think it holds definitely in the top 10 releases there, probably even top 5.
Yeah, easily top 5. Definitely. But yeah, this was a packed year in film, so there could be some debate. The Revenant did beat that. The Revenant was obviously the film of the year according to the Academy Awards.
Yeah, it's definitely in the top 1 for me. So before we go, we have a little promo to play for you guys here on the show. Here's a little chat from Kev about the amazing stuff you can find on Phantom Podcast Network.
Thank you for listening. We hope you're enjoying this podcast. We'd like to recommend these other great podcasts on the Phantom Podcast Network. It starts with our flagship show, Culture Clash, our weekly pop culture podcast with the latest news, reviews, and other fun topics in pop culture. Also, Blood of Kings, a Highlander podcast where we discuss all things Highlander. Couch Potato Theater, our podcast celebrating the cult classic and fan favorite movies we don't get off the couch for. Time Warp, a look back on our classic and nostalgic fandoms that we still celebrate today. The End Zone, our podcast talking about all things current in the NFL and giving our best mediocre fantasy football advice. Good Evening, an Alfred Hitchcock podcast. Discoville, a Star Trek Discovery and the Orville podcast. The Hair Metal Podcast, if you're a hard rock music fan, the Hair Metal Podcast rediscovers the nostalgia of the 1980s hair metal bands. And Type 40, a Doctor Who podcast, as we discuss all things Doctor Who, past and present. You can find these great shows on the Fandom Podcast Master Feed at fpnet.podbean.com. The Fandom Podcast Network is on iTunes, Stitcher, Podbean, Google Play. On Facebook, you can find us at Fandom Podcast Network. On Instagram, we are at Fandom Podcast Network. And on Twitter, at FanPod Network. You can also email us directly at FandomPodcastNetwork@gmail.com. Thank you so much for listening and support the Fandom Podcast Network. And remember, respect others and enjoy your fandom.
Okay, so welcome back to the show. And we're just about to wrap up. But, Kyle, take us through where people can find not only the network, but what shows are available on this fantastic podcast network.
Okay, well, as you heard in the promo, some of the shows we've got, but just kind of a little deeper dive. Of course, you can visit us at our homepage at fpnet.podbean.com. We have Culture Clash, which is hosted by myself and Kevin, is our weekly pop culture show where we cover all the news, reviews, and whatever crazy things come up with. We have Blood of Kings, if you're a Highlander fan, that's covering everything about the Immortals, hosted by Kevin with a lot of great friends, including co-founder Norman Lau. We have Discoville covering all things the Orville and Discovery. that's really getting ready to kick back into high gear as the Orville returns December 30th with Discovery Season 2 coming later in January. We have this show, obviously, Couch Potato Theater, where we look at films that fall into that cult classic category, or there's something very special about them that make them stand out. And of course, we have Time Warp, where we look back at a time in fandom history and talk about the things that are going on in that, in this case right now, where we're doing Time Warp 1985 and the movies of 1985. We also have Good Evening, an Alfred Hitchcock podcast covering everything and everything you need to know about the master of suspense. And of course, Kevin and I hosting the American football show, The End Zone, where there might be bloody battles and mediocre fantasy football advice. And of course, our newest show, too, hosted by some crazy Australian Kevin, covering all things 80s B-movie cinema. You know,
yeah, really? Lethal Mullet, hosted by our very own Adam O'Brien, man.
Yeah, geez, I don't know who that guy is, but might have to check that show.
Yeah, he's a hack.
Yeah. There's a quote, so Alex Autry, there's nothing but a bunch of hacks around here.
So, folks, we're coming to the end of the show now. This is part one of our Fury Road special. This is our thoughts as a team on the film. So I hope you've enjoyed it. And you can also catch the other three volumes of the show on the same network. But we're going to have a part two in the next couple of months, probably sometime in early 2019, where we're going to be looking at friends of ours and listeners' thoughts on Fury Road. We want to celebrate that amazing film because we may not get another one for quite a while, knowing how George Miller's going through trouble on that film. So let's hope we get another film down the line. But I want to thank Kevin and Kyle for being on the show today. Thank you so much, fellas.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you, man.
A blast.
This was a lot of fun to do this four-part series on Mad Max and this franchise. It was fun to revisit these again.
And I still have no chrome. Where is my shiny chrome?
Hey, by the way, I don't know if you remember this or not, Kyle, and Adam, I wanted to ask you real quick. I remember when this film came out, there was some, we have a Home Depot where you go to get all kinds of like, you know, paint and home building supplies. And there was a sign that was put up that people apparently were buying a bunch of this silver paint to do these cosplays. And they were put up a funny sign saying, you know, we're sold out because the war boys took all of our paint.
And I'm going to leave you listeners with the last thoughts is witness me.
G'day, mate. How you going? This is Adam O'Brien and welcome to Fandom Podcast Network. Here, where we enjoy all forms of fandom. Well, coming to you live from Quinlan's Cantina in the Gold Coast of Australia, I bring you Lethal Mullet Podcast, an Australian look at B-grade action films from the 1980s. That's right, going back to that beloved time when we had Chuck Norris on almost every Friday night here in Australia, kicking, punching, and shooting his way to the top, alongside Jean-Claude Van Damme, Arnold Schwarzenegger, and the likes of many of the others that came after him. Sylvester Stallone. We even look at some of the heroes you may not know all here on one fortnightly podcast here on the Fandom Podcast Network. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can check it out also on Podbean if you've got the Podbean app. Make sure you check it out. Now, let's get into the episode here on Fandom Podcast Network.